Hello and welcome to episode 61 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston. So here we are again. We are back refreshed after a short break for the celebration of chocolate that is Easter. Did you survive?
I did. The chocolate came to the house and then it was eaten by the children. I have to admit I was fairly lax and I didn't check to see whether the word Easter was on the boxes of the eggs, so that I could go into some rant on Twitter about the fact that Easter is being taken away by politically correct zealots. So, which is a shame, because you know that's what Easter's all about, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I still can't quite remember from my limited knowledge of researching the Bible where the eggs came into it, to be honest. Let alone the mugs, which are still a firm favourite. Easter mug with egg in.
I think I'll. There's a Homer Simpson quote, I think, that says, "Oh, it's in there somewhere at the back."
So, yeah, probably. And most things are. I also think it's a great shame that we don't, because of obviously political correctness and health and safety, gone mad. You don't get sweets inside chocolate eggs anymore. They're always outside. The eggs are hollow, yet empty, which is like a metaphor for modern life, I'd say.
I see. Well, you know, hopefully this podcast won't be hollow and yet also empty.
It wouldn't be the first time, would it?
Well, you know, a lot of effort goes into this, you know, for sometimes just for such little reward. But it is number 61.
I know.
61st podcast. It's almost unbelievable.
I know. We'll be hitting the ton before the end of the year, for which I think...
If we're spared.
Well, if we're spared, yeah. And if we do make it to that momentous decimal landmark, then I think we probably should throw a party, because that feels like, you know, party level thing. That, or we should produce a commemorative tea towel.
Yeah, if we, I think a tea towel's good, isn't it? A tea towel's not only commemorative and colourful, it's also useful.
Yeah, practical, which is, you know, how I like to think of what we do. Interesting, practical, and able to be able to use to mop up spills. So back to the regular slot without a jingle, the Chris and Matt's yin and yang of the internet. And Chris, this week you have, I think, quality at both ends of the internet spectrum. Let's start, as ever, with the bad stuff. What yin has got your goat on the interwebs? 14 days.
I'm known for quality at both ends. I think if I have a reference ever from an employer, it will be quality at both ends. And what did I talk about? Just something I saw. It was today, actually, as we were as I was whizzing on my way to work. I mean, not actually, you know, whizzing in the lavatory, but whizzing down the railway line, and not in that sense, on the way to work. And it was about a policeman. An ex-policeman, or maybe a current policeman, but anyway, he's a senior policeman who is. There's a story in the Register about how he wants us to fight the net oligarchs. He's very, very, very keen that we shouldn't feel cowed by the massive Facebooks and Googles of this world, and that we should take them to court and sue them in the civil court, which I think is a fine sentiment and probably an excellent thing for people to do, but somewhat impractical, I think. I think we've got enough in our lives going on without trying to take on Facebook in a financially crippling effort. And especially given also that legal aid has been reduced to zero by consecutive administrations. It's nice idea, but maybe slightly fanciful.
Yeah, interesting. So this is Sean Sawyer, who's the chief constable of Devon and Cornwall, but he's also the national lead for human trafficking and modern. And that is the context of this. So it's you never know with the Register, basically, the way they report stuff. But it does seem to be that he's saying that people should, yeah, as you say, sue the likes of Facebook, which is a big gap between understanding a criminal and civil law. But it's an extremely expensive thing to do, to try to sue somebody, especially if you don't have any money.
And if they have a lot of money and teams of highly paid lawyers, it's probably pretty fruitless as well.
It does. I mean, obviously, this is where these networks are at the moment is a particularly interesting point. I was reading about Zuckerberg is being coached about how he can make himself present as a good guy when he goes to Congress in a few days or weeks' time. All of the Cambridge Analytica, etc. stories coming out, and the two separate strands of story there, the one about them harvesting or indirectly harvesting data that they shouldn't have had and then keeping it and then taking it basically out of the Facebook world, and then the second story about them being used as a channel by which different funding mechanisms to be able to put money in elections. Those two things are getting conflated a lot. And what I find, I was reading something else this morning, and I find it, within the context of all of this, that on the one hand we've got this kind of massive media backlash against Facebook, and I do wonder about whether some of this is the traditional media having the opportunity to have a go at Facebook at last, because Facebook have pretty much stolen their lunch. The likes of Facebook completely turned over the traditional media. But then at the same time, we've got people quite willing to have things like Alexa in their house listening to every word that they say. And I don't know. I don't get necessarily that there is a huge wake up around privacy or any of this stuff. It just there's something that, I don't know, I can't quite put my finger on it, but it doesn't feel actually necessarily. There's a turning point in the media, but I don't think that's the same as a turning point the way in which consumers are thinking about.
No, you're absolutely right. The media stories are essentially, as you say, a chance to kick up the competition. And whilst if I was feeling remarkably charitable, I might believe that Zuckerberg, for example, believes in his mission, that he's doing good for everybody, and only by accident is doing bad things. Cambridge Analytica, on the other hand, are quite happily doing anything for money, I think. But there are, yeah, you're right. I mean, the fact that we are forever giving our information away and continue to do so. There was a good XKCD. I mean, I think that might have been the last Yin and Yang things we did was an XKCD cartoon. And it was it was today, isn't it? It's about people essentially opening themselves up to tax fraud because paperwork is difficult. Now people are taking pictures of all of their receipts and uploading them to the cloud, and therefore tying ever more personal financial data to yourself in the cloud. It's only going to go in one way, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I don't know. And then the other bit of all of this is, yes, and they've got all this data, and yet still, internet marketing is rubbish. I spent 7 days on the Isle of Wight. I am now getting bombarded by Sainsbury's on Twitter telling me that their new Nectar card is launching in the Isle of Wight in the next few days. And that's like 5 or 6 days since my geolocation has moved from the Isle of Wight. I no longer am in the Isle of Wight. Still, they're bombarding me with this crap. If this is the high point of what is going on, and I'm certain that what is being spent by the likes of Sainsbury's on social media dwarfs anything that you can imagine is being spent by political parties on this stuff. If this is the high point of it, it has such little effect that it really isn't worth it. And of course, you can never test this because you can never run an election as a double-blind test. It's completely open to conjecture and nobody will ever prove either way. But nonetheless, the evidence in front of me day in, day out is that this stuff is just so rubbish still.
Anyway. Well, indeed. Indeed. Anyway, let's talk about something pleasant.
Let's do that. So what's your yang? What is it from the internet that has piqued your interest?
Well, the Yang is a splendid effort. It's a website called 11foot8.com, and it's the number 11, the word foot, and the number 8.com. And it's essentially a collection of videos which show a particular bridge, I guess, in the US. And the bridge is 11 foot 8 high, and so if you're driving a high vehicle, you won't get under it. And there's a big flashing sign over it as well. It tells you, drivers that are heading towards it, it flashes if they're too high, and it says don't go under here. You're going to hit the bridge. But the videos show all of the people that ignore it. So there are loads of these videos of high lorries smashing into this bridge and having the tops taken off them. And I just think it's a beautiful kind of metaphor for people's ability to follow instructions or to believe what they're told. You know, maybe it's a bit of a Brexit thing, you know, that is here, or a global warming climate change thing, where no matter that something is telling them in quite simple language that they're going to head towards harm, they know better, and the terrible fate that awaits them. It's beautiful, actually. I think it's quite poetic in its own way.
Yeah, there's a kind of I remember on a PlayStation there was this game which involved you having to just drive a car into an intersection and see how many things you could smash into, and it's got that element of kind of disaster porn about it. But the metaphorical thing, yeah, absolutely, there is this thing about how we won't act until it's too late. You see this in politics, you see this in business all the time. It doesn't matter what the leading indicators are. It will not happen until the disaster actually strikes, because otherwise people go, oh, we don't need to spend on that, do we? Because look, yeah. And that actually is, there's something really quite, how do you get people to change their behaviour so that they actually act on data that they're being given? It's actually a piece of work I'm about to start this week with the health going to be in. But it is really hard to get people to actually act on data. We don't do it. It's not a human. It's just not how we operate. And so this is a great metaphor for that. And you get the opportunity. But I warn you now, it's not every single one. They tease you. It's not like just a crash after crash after crash. It's occasional crashes interspersed with near misses. It is a thing of beauty.
It really is. And I recommend it to our listenership.
Anyway, links, as ever, will be on the webpage for both Chris's Yin and Chris's Yang.
So, Matt, you have not been idle over the Easter holidays, have you, since the last time we did this podcast? As you've been chuntering away in digital form. You wrote recently about parking, and something I've been grumbling about for a while when the mood takes me. And it's not actually about parking, really. Parking is an example, but it's about how the public sector especially goes about digitising things, and why it is that these digitised services don't actually save any money, or at least we don't pay any less, whether they're saving any money somewhere else, but they decide not to pass on the savings to the poor taxpayer. There's another question, I suppose. Where did you get to with this?
So the origins of this were having spent the last week on the Isle of Wight, and the Isle of Wight Council, which is like many councils in the UK now, but basically to park anywhere on the Isle of Wight you have to pay, which is fair enough. I don't have a problem with paying for parking. In most places what you have is a machine, and the machine is able to dispense tickets by putting in money, usually in coin variety. But I think the ones on the Isle of Wight very rarely, if any of them, had credit cards. And then
I think they still take 30 bits on the one on the Isle of Wight.
Almost certainly, which probably you could use a pound coin and replace that. You then also have the option to be able to use an app. And the one that the Isle of Wight Council have chosen on is one called Pay by Phone. There's another one called Ringo that I know local councils around where I live seem to have decided upon. And the apps are, you know, they're okay. They're not anything great, but it does give you advantage with pay and display car parts that you can pay some money, and then if you decided actually you don't need an hour, you need an hour and a half or 2 hours, then you can top up without having to go back to your car and then timing it right and then sticking money in and running out of change and all the other stuff that goes with it. The thing that, and this has been in my head for ages because I use these services infrequently at home, but using them just about every day, they charge you an extra 30p per transaction to use the app. And by any reckoning, something has gone really quite wrong when a service that is being delivered supposedly purely digitally is charged at a premium to something that involves devices stuck on hillsides with having to maintain network connections and electricity connections and have them regularly emptied of actual cash money and printing and bits of paper, and that it's cheaper to use that antediluvian setup than it is to use the app. Something is fundamentally wrong with the way in which councils are procuring and implementing these services. And it was too much for me by the end of a week of doing this, and I just had to kind of distill thoughts down on it a bit. And the things that it kind of brings home for me is, first of all, that there is there's a big difference between adding a digital channel to an existing set of services and truly digitizing or making that service, you know, pure digital service, which is even further away from rethinking how you might take advantage of digital in such a way that it makes the thing better. Now, the analogy I've often used for this, and it seems kind of slightly timely at the moment given recent IPOs and Swiss flags, is the music industry. So the music industry started off as an analog industry with records. Before that, it was an industry that was just about playing stuff, and then you had printed paper, music, and publishing, and then you had records, and then they started to expand out on other analog formats with 8-track and then cassette. And then in the early 80s, we had the emergence of the first digital format, which was CD. And then over time, the fulfillment went from a purely analog world of going into a shop. I used to go into Our Price in Watford quite a lot. I remember it up by the pond, lovely place, spent lots of money in there as a kid. And then from there, we had the emergence of digital transactions. So you were able to go to Amazon and buy CDs, but the CDs would be the post. And then with the emergence of the iPod, we then started to have the digital fulfillment of the music. But even with iPod and iTunes, in first instance, that was still basically the same business model that it had always been, which was you pay for a piece of limited license for some music, and the content of that music, what you're actually buying is the rights to listen to that music. It's not the music itself. And it wasn't until serious competition from Napster, which basically gave all the music away for free, that we saw responses to that music industry being purely digital, which came from YouTube and monetization of music through advertising. Whether the music people are able to monetize it through advertising or not is another matter. And then through the emergence of streaming services like Spotify, where you move from having a pay per purchase of a license that lasts forever to a subscription model to be able to listen to stuff, whatever you want, for as much as you want on a periodic. The pay on an app parking thing is like going to Amazon to buy a CD. That's how far we've got down the train. The only difference is when you bought something on Amazon on CD, you'd also get it cheaper. So it's like going to Amazon in the late 1990s to buy a CD and them charging you up to 100% more for the CD rather than going into Virgin Records.
Yeah, I think there's lots to be said for that, isn't there? Because people don't actually, they don't get rid of the old process. They add something else to it, and that's so. Therefore, the machines are still there, and the collections from the machines are still there, and all this stuff is still there. But now they're doing something extra, and somebody's had to deploy the app and pay for all of the project that goes around that. So that they've decided to recoup their costs, I guess. But there's no removal of the original service in that sense. So that seems to be the reason. It's not done as a cost saving. It's done as a digital improvement or some kind of we must have an app and all of that sort of thing. So the mindset appears to be slightly flawed in that sense. And also, it's very rarely done in a joined up way, is it? You never, you know, it's all, those things are always very piecemeal, and then you're invited to download an app which just does that thing for that council, or even that car park. I mean, this occurred to me. I was in Manchester last year, and I was going up to Manchester a fair bit, and I downloaded about 3 apps for car parks, and they were all uniformly terrible. Couldn't really figure out how any of them worked, and ended up fishing around for change for machines, which the world's moved on. Maybe we don't carry so much change. You know, it's not a man's thing anymore to carry a bunch of keys and a pocket full of these change as it used to be.
But the thing is, think back to the last show, and I talked a little bit about the chap who was a future of mobility, future of automotive commentator, and we are on the cusp of really, really significant changes to the way in which people move around. And basically, at the moment, councils, to the large part, when it comes to parking, have not really moved on from the old mechanical parking meters that were in service up until, the 1980s, when we started to see these new machines come in that offered tickets out. But the old ones with there'll be a picture of one on the website, because I took a picture of one in the design museum. Beautiful objects, you know, the sound of things that look like a lollipop, and they put the coins in the side, and then a big expired thing comes up when you've run out of time. The things that we have to be able to manage parking in cities today have not really fundamentally moved on from that. And we are having to pay more to be able to have a little bit of additional convenience. Whereas what we should be thinking about is, how could we use dynamic parking to help do things like traffic flow across towns and cities? If you could make parking cheaper in some places and more expensive in others at different times of the day, you could start to help make sure that traffic was going into places which were less congested. So you could use parking and pricing of parking as a mechanism to be able to help even out congestion in cities, which is just a problem everywhere. We're so far away from anything like that happen. And moreover, I can bet all these local authorities who have done the Ringos or the pay by what's it, you can bet, you know, they've ticked off and they go, hey, look at us, we've done digital transformation on parking, we've got digital parking in place. It's fabulous. I was reading something from Croydon Council on the British Parking Societies. I look at these things, I do research. Literally, there's this big crowing article in the Parking Monthly or whatever it is their industry newspaper is, talking about how Croydon have implemented some new machines that are basically the same sorts of machines we've had on the street since the 1940s. We've not moved on anywhere.
I'm still reeling from the idea that you spent your Easter holiday reading parking news or whatever it is in the year. But I'm glad that you do the research. I feel slightly inadequate now, having not read into the car parks of our world. I think it's my view is because it's siloed, like so much digital investment. It is siloed. Somebody who runs car parks thinks, well, do you know what? If we do this, then we'll have slightly less cash collection to do, and it'll be much easier to reconcile, because we're not, you know, people aren't ferrying huge bags of 50 pences from the car parks, and that'll be good. But it's not tied into a digital strategy. I can't imagine many town councils, other than the sort of big metropolitan guys, I can't imagine many of them have what you might call a digital strategy. Even now, which is a bit of a shame, really, because a lot of services are delivered digitally, and a lot of, you know, my home council, I wouldn't say the services are delivered digitally, but the websites are pretty informative. They're kept up to date. You know, you can do certain things online. Not much of it is joined up, but you can, if you fancy wasting some of your time and throwing whelks into a supernova, you can report potholes, and then, you know, one day somebody might come and fill a pothole in, but it's not joined up, it's not set out in as a plan. It's just let's put an application on our car parks, let's build a web service to let people tell us that their bin hasn't been collected. It's pretty piecemeal.
So there are a number of barriers in the way of this getting better. And after this break, we'll have a bit of a discussion about where one of them might lie. Back in episode 45, we interviewed Hilary Gallo, and this week found out that Hilary has got a new book, which he is working with the online crowdfunding publishing service Unbound with. And the new book is called Fear Hack, and the core idea is, what if we weren't fearful of fear? Interesting stuff. If you want to find out more, you can find it on unbound.com/books/fear-hack.
So, after that message from our sponsors, we've got, we'll go back to that discussion. We've said that it's not, obviously, often there's not a strategy, and some of this stuff is very piecemeal. And what can we do about that? How can local authorities and the public sector approach this differently? That's thrown into sharp relief by the recent, dismemberment of GDS as a concept and as a department, really, or a part of the Cabinet Office, not a full department. So, and you've done some work with those guys, Matt. How do you see the parallels between the GDS and what's happening there and the kind of things we've been talking about?
So I think the thing, for me, the thing that is blocking kind of deeper looking at stuff like parking or transport or whatever else is the fact that you need to get a number of different groups aligned and heading in the same direction. To be able to make anything meaningful change, you need to have technologists who understand the potential of technology and can also be able to think about how it might be applied. You need policymakers, so people who are civil servants, whether at local or national, who are able to interpret what is coming from the politicians to be able to make sense of how that gets executed. You need the politicians to be setting a direction for this stuff for real change rather than this kind of digital washing at the top. And you need all of us, or at least enough of a majority of us, to be able to be in support of it so it doesn't look like political suicide. And we're just nowhere near any of that happening at the moment. Now, GDS, the Government Digital Service, set up after work that was done by the lady who set up lastminute.com, Martha Lane Fox, and that came out in the first couple of years of the 2010 Liberal Conservative coalition, those happy days when politics just meaningless crap as opposed to completely hats down. And we had a group set up in central government within the Cabinet Office, which is the kind of admin branch of British, whose responsibility was to be able to drive agendas of digital transformation across the whole of government. Now, there's lots of folklore about why that was successful and how successful it was and has been. I think by many analyses, the reason why it had primarily a level of success in terms of making things change was a combination of it was actively being sponsored by Francis Maude, who is a politician who has experience and influence Conservative Party, is a senior member of, and so was somebody who knew how the party operated and how to be able to get things done, and who was a grandee, was able to be seen as be respected. Traditionally, the Cabinet Office has not been led particularly by people at that sort of level of experience and seniority, and certainly not those who then have also got an agenda around let's do something digitally. And Francis Maude left at the last but one election, I'm losing count of these now, and he since then, I think there have been 3-4 ministers for the Cabinet Office. There was Hancock, there was the one who lost his seat in Ipswich, there was the one who had to resign because of hanky-panky and being a bit handsy, and when I say that, I mean because he was a gratuitous pest, and I don't even know who it is now. And there just hasn't been any focus or attention on the digital. And the other reason why GDS had a modicum of success was because it had financial spend control over anything that was going on in central government that was anything citizen-facing digital, and anything over, I think, £100,000 that was internal, that was in any... And if you've got control over purse strings like that, you have clout. And so there was an approval process that meant that anything that was in the sort of realm of digital had to go through an approvals process that was being managed by GDS. There's a bunch of other things that they did, and, you know, yeah, they managed to make government websites all look alike, and I think there's, you know, there's pros and cons of that, and quite frankly, I don't think that it's the great thing that everybody associated it was. And actually, when you look at it, there have been incredibly few examples where there has been really deep, meaningful transformation using digital to fundamentally change how things are done. There's been a lot of surface change to be able to give consistency in user experience, and that's all good, but there hasn't been, I don't think, really. The only public sector example I can think of, something that is a digital project ground up that has had a significant effect and change on how, is a congestion charge project in London, which predates all this GDS stuff and is something that could have only have happened through the use of digital technology, number plate recognition, billing, all the rest, and it has made a significant difference to port travels around in London. But it's really hard to do this stuff. And now what we're seeing is, with recent announcements officially made now, that data and open data and government data is now going to be owned by and sport, and there are people leaving GDS and have done since Mike Bracken left years back now, but people leaving left, right and centre, and there is no centre thing for it. It seems to be fragmenting, and I'm not convinced that there is it is decentralizing at a point when there has been enough work done centrally to get things working.
Yes, it's there's a lot of big politics going on, isn't there, in terms of departments claiming back their ground maybe they lost to GDS when they weren't looking, and digital's become digital. Look, see, I just use the word as if it's a thing. Digital's become a really important piece rather than a bit of a sideline. But I think it's also a function of how government approaches this kind of thing. It's government is split into departments, and departments aren't necessarily silos, and they think about this data in those ways. And when they try to collect it or use it in a joined up way, it turns into this sort of horrible digital economy stuff where they're just harvesting enormous data sets rather than thinking of workflows across departments. So I think it's just a mindset issue, isn't it? And I don't think the government in that sense is capable of thinking in a different way. Maybe that's the problem.
Or if it is, it's not when you've then got, I mean, you know, if you look at the broader political landscape at the moment, there's stuff on at the moment that's kind of occupying everybody's mind. So, you know, things like how might we make, how might we fundamentally rethink how we do parking across the country ain't going to get any airtime anytime soon, because there's just too much going through at the moment that has led to little attention on anything. I'm not going to mention the word, you know what it is. But I think also this thing about having senior political alignment with policymaking alignment, with technology alignment, is a thing. There was this moment, this brief moment at the time when GDS was formed and started, where those three things sort of came into alignment in a small but significant number of places in government. I'm not convinced that there really is much going on there now. And then you've also got, you know, whether it's thinking that the Northern Irish border can be done through technology, or whether necessary hashtags, or, you know, whatever else, there's also a lot of evidence that there's a distinct lack of savviness in some of the current crop of senior politicians when they do turn their mind to it. But a lot of the stuff that needs to be done is actually really dull. And, you know, really dull stuff ain't going to happen at a time when there's massive, great global political things that are taking up the agenda. But it's just a time when, if it doesn't happen now, what state will government be in 5 years' time if we get this kind of atrophy going on? And it's you know, let's not beat around the bush here. There has been incredible movement in getting people to think about user needs across government. That message has landed. I've met with lots of people now who understand the needs of users should determine how you define system. But that is just such a small thing when it comes to actually really thinking about how how could you fundamentally rethink something? And I just, I don't know. I mean, I don't particularly pine for the loss of GDS if it is going to certainly it's contracted. But I wonder whether there has been a naivety about thinking that stuff has changed more than it may be.
I think there have also been some changes in a slightly less visible way around open data. That will be something that I will be, that maybe has, I don't know, I'm not entirely sure it's to do with the momentum it once did. And some of the, and I think partly that's because GDS has lost some of its clout. So once upon a time, they were told departments and functions that they must release data and they must release it in a timely manner and it must be in a readable format and that doesn't include PDFs, et cetera, et cetera. If you look at the open data pages now in government, there's still quite a lot of PDFs, there's still quite a lot of out-of-date stuff. They still take quite a lot of time to post it. And I think some of the impetus has gone because of the things you've described around GDS losing its driving forces. But actually, where that's worked really well, it's a bit of a poster boy for government around the world in terms of sharing information, making it available, making data sets available for people to do their own things, making so people can write their own apps or do their own analysis and provide an app that will tell you where the nearest chemist is or tell you when the next bus is coming and things like that, rather than for it all to be locked away in private data sets. So I think that's a movement that really deserves some encouragement. And I think it probably, in the long term, is more important than what the government does with the data, if you know what I mean, in terms of public services. Because hopefully, and maybe this is slightly naive, but as we become more data savvy, we can do more with it as a society, maybe.
Yeah, and that's a fair point. And it also, I guess, comes back to the stuff about government as a platform, which was the idea that was introduced by Tim O'Reilly in an essay. Oh, it was about 2010, I think it was. Fantastic, fantastic essay where he said that what the duty of government should be is to provide platforms upon which countries and economies can grow. And so the sorts of examples that would be there with major infrastructural projects like road buildings. I mean, you and I have had the conversation on the show in the past about how, you know, should the broadband network be part of the government as a platform? The GDS interpretation of that became much more a platform for government, which is how they could do things like Verify, which is this idea of a single shared service for doing identity, which turned into this behemoth of loads of providers like Experian, and it's never really taken off, or payment gateways, so that, you know, government had one place where they could authorize the transactions of payments out, and these kind of things. They were good architectural ideas, but they weren't the same as providing things upon which, you know, the wealth of the nation could be built. And I think you're right. I think you know, thinking about how opening up government data to be do things that, you know, who knows how they might get used, is a really good example of government as a platform. And there are lots of people still really working hard around that kind of stuff. It's, I guess then the question is, though, actually, how much does that cost and how serious are government about doing that? Because although there is more open published data now, it's hard. It's really hard to provide machine usable data sets. It's one thing to provide machine readable data sets, but machine usable data sets, there aren't that many of them. And, you know, it's expensive to do and it's esoteric. And it's, you know, I've done lots of data modeling over my life and I've yet to find somebody who isn't a, you know, a hardcore data geek who really gets, you know, and I've met a lot of data scientists who don't understand the value of data modeling, but I don't know. Maybe that is the future. Maybe thinking about how they're able to be able to get back to that core idea that O'Reilly had about government as a platform can be the future.
So that's many hobby horses put out to pasture, to mix a few metaphors. What does the week hold for you then, Matt, before we meet again?
Kickoff of a new piece of work with client, hopefully. I tell you what, actually, I've got lots of stuff for the podcast coming up this week, because my big collaboration project has come to a close now, so a bit of time to be able to go out and meet some people. So in the week ahead, if all goes to plan, I have got some time tomorrow with our drawing friend Natalia, and she and I are going to be hopefully recording the first few episodes of a mini podcast about how to draw using the radio, which I think is an interesting mix of something. And then I am meeting up with somebody who is a content marketing specialist, but to talk about what is content marketing, which should be interesting. And then I am meeting up with Charlotte G from IDG, who I'm going to go and have a chat with her about her fantastic campaign to get more women speakers and women panelists at technology events, which she's been plugging away at for quite some time now. And I'm going to go and have a chat with her about how that is going and what it's achieving. So that's going to be fun. And which means that next week and the week after, maybe even the week after that, we've got shows where it's not me ranting.
That's good. You know, that's got to be a good thing. That's got to be a... we should have more or less of you ranting.
That's why we do the interviews.
But we... it makes me feel quite sad. I haven't done interviews recently, because every time I go to work at the moment, it's one of those things where I sit down and then I don't do some stuff, and then I look at the clock and it's about 2:30, and then the next time I look at the clock, everybody's gone and it's time to go home. So it's a hectic time. But I've got one or two interviews lined up as well. One or two very nice ones. So we'll hopefully have a lot of good stuff this year. I think there's plenty to aim for over the summer.
Absolutely. So that's the week ahead. Thank you for listening to me rant on again. Hey.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Mr. Valentine. So that's all from us. You can catch us, as usual, at WB40 Podcast on Twitter, at WB40podcast.com on the internet, and on many podcasting platforms.